is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have Steve Beekman, who's the CEO of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. In the studio, we'll talk about how the campaign is coming along. They have moved into their new facility in Merrillville. How successful has it been since the move? Well, we'll find out more, and we'll also find out what's next for the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. Another edition of Green Fleet Radio with your host, Carl Lissick, is also on the way. And we'll talk with the Vice President for U.S. Restaurant Development at McDonald's Corporation in Chicago. Rob Lancaster will tell us about the big modernization program for a lot of restaurants in Indiana, including Northwest Indiana. Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. Steve Beekman, who's the CEO of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, is in the studio to bring us up to date on the major projects that have happened since the last time we talked, which was when they had their grand opening for the new facility, and new by means of not being a new building, but certainly new digs for the food bank. They've been located in a much smaller location in Gary for a number of years, and they have now relocated to Broadway in Merrillville. I think it was an old moving company storage area, wasn't it, I believe, before? It's probably been a number of things in its past, but now it's the new home for the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It used to, I think most people remember it as the old Handy Andy's, if people have been living in the region for a while.
So it used to be a hardware store, basically,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, that's what
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah.
Sorry. Well, tell us now, since taking over the building, what you all have done to it, and how now it's been a major help in being able to move along to your goals of providing more food for people that need it the most here in the region.
Oh, yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me on, too. I think it's just a few months ago, we actually made the public announcement of our capital campaign, Fighting Hunger, Building Hope, which is a $4 million capital campaign to not only to purchase the location, but also rebuild a lot of the infrastructure of this new facility in order to fulfill the mission of fighting hunger and feeding people throughout the region that are either food insecure or are in poverty. And so for many years, we've been operating out of what we call as the Red Barn, which is a very small barn that was repurposed into a food bank. Through this, we were distributing about 4.5 million meals throughout Lake and Porter counties, which is a huge effort with this type of facility. And in order to meet the need of our service area of Lake and Porter County, what we know is there's about 100,000 people that are food insecure that need food assistance. They have lack of access or ability to get healthy, nutritious foods for themselves and their family. So in order to provide enough meals for that those number of people, we need to be distributing about 17 million meals. So we have a wow. huge gap between 4.5 and 17 million to just meet the need of people in our area. And so we focused on getting a new location, a new facility where there's more space, more efficiencies, where we can have docks, so we can run our organization more efficiently to better serve the community. And so just a few months ago, we made that public announcement that we're about 65% to our goal. We have an additional about $1.4 million that we're still trying to generate in order to complete the entire build-out of the facility. But we know that in order to help the people in need immediately, we needed to move out of that Gary location into the new Merrillville location. It's going from 12,000 to 72,000 square foot,
wow,
which provides a lot more space for us to accept donated product, purchase food, as well as other USDA program foods that we can actually qualify for. So that's a huge impact that we can immediately make. So our plans for the capital campaign was to break it up in two different segments, phase one and phase two. Phase one gets us in there with the bare necessities that we can operate in this new facility. And the priority is freezer cooler space. So often at our old facility, we turned away free donated food because of lack of space. So now we're able to accept all types of donated product. A lot of it's we're focusing on healthy, nutritious foods. To put in perspective, the very first week that we moved in, we accepted 28 pallets of fresh strawberries. So at the old location, we would have probably turned that down because of lack of space to be able to not only store it, but also space to be able to distribute it out. So now that we're in the space, we can definitely serve more meals to the public, which is a huge, huge accomplishment for the organization and as our staff. It's exciting because we can really make it just a huge impact by just having more space and more efficiencies with this new location.
To give our listeners an idea, what did you actually get to do with those 28 pallets of strawberries?
Yeah, so how we do that is we take those pallets and we distribute it out through our network. So this is our local food pantries you might have in your own community, your own soup kitchen, and that's how we distribute the foods out. A lot of people confuse us with as a food pantry, but there's only one food bank in the region that provides food through local food pantries, and that's us. And so I think this facility kind of speaks to that by the size of it and the capacity that we're trying to enable all of our local network agencies, food pantries, soup kitchens, to provide more healthier, nutritious foods to people in need. And by having this building, we can easily do that. And so those 28 pallets of strawberries went throughout our network.
And I bet it went out very fast, too, I would imagine, besides the fact that they're fresh produce, they have to go out fast, which, like you say before, because you had no way to store it and no way to distribute it, if you could even have taken it in over at the Gary location, it wouldn't have mattered. It would have gotten spoiled probably by the time somebody got it.
And yep, exactly.
One of the information points that has got passed out when the latest information came in here was mentioning that in the first 2 weeks of operation in the new facility that you were able to accept 50,000 pounds of food that would otherwise have been turned away.
Yes.
That's 50,000 pounds of food is just mind-boggling anyway. We think we haul enough stuff home from the supermarket in our car or our minivan just to take care of a family. That's just unbelievable that you would be able to handle so much stuff to be able to distribute it.
Yeah, a lot of our product we get is in bulk product. So it's on pallets of different types of product that we were able to get. And just being part of Feeding America and having great relationships with local food retail, as you will, like the Walmarts, the Strack and Van Til, the Jewel Osco's. They provide a lot of donated product through retail pickup that we go and pick up on a daily basis to bring it back to our facility and distribute out through our network. We also get semi-loads of product as well going throughout the region, out throughout the nation. So it's quite the network of being able to accept different types of load of product and food throughout the whole country. And so now we can actually have those type of meaningful conversations with local vendors to help with serving people in need of food by saying, hey, can you lower your costs? Can you donate some product to us now? Because as I mentioned before, we used to say we can't accept it because we don't have the space. That's not our challenge anymore.
Does everybody at the food bank feel more confident now that you can attend to the issues of food insecurity in the region to try to basically dry up these food deserts that we hear so much about? Where because of the fact that we have populations that are not close enough to supermarkets, residents are relying a lot more on a food pantry or some type of food drop-off point.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for our first step is to, as I said, move into a new facility so we can access more food to be able to distribute that throughout the region. So that's our step one to help serve people that are in food deserts, the people who are in need, people who are food or are in poverty. But it's a complex challenge for people. You know, it could be lack of employment or unemployed that creates challenges for people, or lack of transportation, or a lack of other resources that they might not have to overcome their barriers for the situation they're in. Two things that prevent food insecurity is money and access to food. And so what we want to do with this new facility, as I mentioned before, it's a very large facility compared to what we were in. But we want to leverage our ability to get food in order to serve the people better in our area. So we want to take that next step beyond providing short-term relief of food insecurity or hunger. We want to try to create long-term program solutions to hunger by creating job training programs, educating not only our clients that we serve, but the network, even the community as a whole. We need to provide more healthier, nutritious foods to people in need and throughout the whole region, because if people are having to choose between paying for their medical bill or buying healthy, nutritious foods, so often people choose to pay for their medical bills or their car payment or rent. So they opt into the cheap, probably not so healthy meals, which really over a long period of time creates health issues and health problems, which really compounds their problem of having to go to the doctor, making those type of payments, medical bills. And it just creates the cycle of the situation they're in. So we're trying to create long-term solutions to this new facility. And that's why this second phase of this capital campaign is so important, because that's what this is going to fund. It's going to fund our demonstration kitchen. It's going to create a commercial kitchen where we can house a job training program for unemployed or unemployed people to create long-term solutions to people that are in need of food assistance, that are able to work. They're able to get back on track to be self-sustaining. That's a critical part of what we're trying to do. Our end goal is not to provide all the meals to everyone. Our goal is to try to end hunger. And it's a very complex challenge. And it's going to take not only food, but other resources to overcome all these barriers that people are faced with every day.
I know, I recall the last time we talked over at the facility that one of the things that you hoped to do in the beginning of the campaign that got you to the point where you were able to relocate from Gary into Merrillville was to get more people involved, whether it was a community, a nonprofit, or any other organization like that involved, but volunteers. Mm-hmm. I take it that's still the goal. That's one of the things that the next phase will help establish.
Oh, exactly. It's kind of remarkable how our organization are able to utilize so many volunteers. We depend on volunteers to help take that bulk product of food and repackage it, resort it, and enable us to distribute that out in smaller quantities to our agencies. So we really do depend on volunteers. Our estimation is about 2,000 volunteers come to us every year to help do that for us. With this new facility, we're expecting more and more type of volunteers, but also different ways to volunteer as well, beyond just packing a senior box for seniors or packing a backpack for the backpack program for kids. There's a lot of different ways to volunteer now, but we do depend on volunteers. And one of the things we know is people didn't know where we were before. We were on 35th Avenue and Grant Street. People just really didn't have an idea where that was at. Now that we're on 6490 Broadway in Merrillville, it's a very central location for a lot of people to easily come to us. We have enough space for parking.
Well,
we have enough space.
I was going to mention, you have plenty of parking spaces. So if you get these volunteers to come in for, say, like for example, like a United Way Day of Caring decides to help put up meals, and I know that the Lake Area United Way has done that, where they've been able to bring the items in, and they've had the volunteers come in, and they've actually put up meals, which in turn have gotten turned back around and gone out to the food pantries and the like. But you can't do any operations, even if you had the space, which you do now, without having space to bring all these folks in to park and do whatever volunteer effort.
Yeah, so our limit was 20 volunteers at a time at the old facility. Now we can accept hundreds at a time, depending on the project. So it really does transform what we're able to do in this new space. And you mentioned volunteers. We're purposely inviting the public to a lot of our events upcoming in the early fall. Just want to mention that September is Hunger Action Month across the country, and we're really trying to expose our facility to the general public to not only help us complete this capital campaign project of $1.4 million, but also help us create these long-term program solutions with the programs, as I mentioned. And there's a lot of these events where people can get engaged with. The very first day, September 1st, we're hosting our mobile marketplace distribution where we're trying to serve 600 families in need at our location. And also on the same day, we're doing a Ride the Region. We're having motorcycle riders from all over the region to do a 75-mile ride, starting at the food bank and finishing at Wild Rose Brewery Company in Griffith. And so it's just getting people exposed to what we're trying to do. I think when people visually see it, they get the understanding. I think we had a conversation off air about just physically seeing the facility, you get a different perspective of the size and scope of what we're trying to do, and it's impactful. It's going to have a tremendous impact in the community. And so these events that we're hosting is will help other people to understand that.
Well, Steve, we're going to have to get back together again. Certainly more during the month of September when you're going to have all these programs going again, too, to bring us up today. Maybe by then the next phase of the campaign will be met or on the way. That's the best you could hope for, I suppose, now. We've been talking with Steve Beekman. He's the CEO of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. They have made great inroads in making expansion and relocation from the old facility in Gary to a much larger and much more comprehensive operation in Merrillville along Broadway, and it's going to mean more food that'll be available for people who need it the most. Steve, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Again, thank you very much for that introduction, and welcome to Green Fleet Radio. Our guest today is Mr. Kevin Moore. He's the president of Midwest Wind and Solar. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Good to be here.
Tell our listeners, Kevin, what is Midwest Wind and Solar and what do you do?
Yeah, Midwest Wind and Solar is a renewable energy company. We primarily today focus on solar.
Mm-hmm.
However, you'll see in our name we have wind. So we do solar electric, solar thermal, and we do wind power.
You're busy.
We're busy.
You're busy.
Yeah.
Busy group.
It's a great technology to be in today.
So we know there are several myths when it comes to solar. So can you tell our listeners, you know, people believe solar isn't viable in the Midwest and that it's too cloudy or too cold to work here. Can you talk about that a little, Kevin?
Yeah, that's a it's a very common misconception. You know, us Midwesterners, the rain, the snow, the clouds, it just doesn't work in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And solar technology in the Midwest is about 15% less efficient than in the states that we think solar is really great
sure.
in, so Florida, Arizona, California. And quite surprisingly, Indiana outperforms Florida 4 months out of the year in solar production. So
that's an amazing statistic.
Yeah, it is a surprise.
Wow, wow. So I know there's some confusion about solar and batteries for storing solar energy. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, the big misconception about solar is there's got to be some way to store that energy when you're not utilizing it. And the great thing is that there's a technology or a program out there called net metering.
Mm-hmm.
And net metering allows the excess production, let's say you're away from the home during the day, you're getting a lot of solar production, and where does that energy go? It actually spins your electric meter backwards. So you get kilowatt hour credits. And then when you come back during the day, there's no solar production. You actually run your meter forwards again, and you take those credits back off your back off the grid again.
Sure. So, you know, we've heard that argument about solar being too expensive or that it has a long payback period, but before you can achieve a return on your investment. So what is the reality when it comes to investing in solar?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And 7 to 8 years ago, I'd absolutely agree with
mm-hmm.
you. I mean, it was a newer or not so much used technology. And I like to compare it to the cell phone era. So if you remember back in the early days when cell phones came out, and you know, the big bag phones, they
mm-hmm.
were the, you know, the technology was expensive, the service was expensive,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. And as more and more people begin to use that technology, the cost went down. The same thing's happening with solar technology. More and more people are utilizing it, therefore the costs are going down. And the cost to install solar has dropped by more than 70%
wow.
since 2010.
That's amazing.
So in the last 8 years, it's gone down 70%.
It's fantastic. It's Carl Lissick with Green Fleet Radio. Our guest today is Mr. Kevin Moore, president of Midwest Wind and Solar. So, Kevin, we're at South Shore Clean Cities, we're interested in sustainable transportation and sustainable energy. So we're hearing a lot more about solar charging for electric vehicles. So is solar a good way to offset electricity expenses?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely. It's a great way to offset the cost of charging an electric vehicle,
mm-hmm.
Both from an economic and environmental standpoint. For example, the Nissan Leaf has a combined fuel economy rating of 30 kilowatt hours per 100 miles.
I see.
So that means a Leaf requires 30 kilowatt hours of energy, of electricity, to drive 100 miles. So let's say if you drive 25 miles on an average day, that means you're using approximately 7.5 kilowatt hours of electricity per day, or just over 2,700 kilowatt hours of electricity in a year. So this is about the amount of electricity you'll need your solar energy system to produce.
I see.
So what does that mean in real terms as far as, you know, all that lingo there? What does that mean in the real world? Mm-hmm. How many solar panels would I need? You'd need about 310-watt solar modules, and that would produce 3,700 kilowatt hours per year of energy. So that's more than enough to power your Leaf and give you some extra for the house. So 10 solar panels would cover you if you drove 25 miles every single day, 365 days a year.
Great information. Great information. So how can people learn more about Midwest Wind and Solar, Kevin?
Yeah, the best way is to go to our website, MidwestWindAndSolar.com, or feel free to give us a call.
You know, Kevin, I know we've been involved with many projects with Midwest Wind and Solar, and you guys have just been fantastic to work with, you know, great community partner with so many people, not only with South Shore Clean Cities. And, you know, I just want to say publicly thank you so much for all the work and support that you've done for so many schools and governmental entities and homeowners across our great state of Indiana. So it's just, you know, it's a pleasure, folks. If you ever have the opportunity to work with them, definitely a great asset to our area here. So, Kevin, any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program?
Yeah, I know recently you had Bill McCall from the toll road and he mentioned their programs. We were fortunate to be selected as the company to install all of the solar on the toll road. And just a quick few little statistics behind that, we installed 508 kilowatts. That's 508,000 watts of solar on the toll road. That translates into 1,638 solar modules are now on the toll road. So great great program that the toll road is doing. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so we're
– That's exciting. So locations, I mean, will people see those off around the toll road when they're traveling the toll road?
Surprisingly, actually, they don't get to see them. Okay. They are – when they're refueling their vehicle, they're on the canopies right up above them.
Wonderful.
And they're also on the buildings, but they can't see them from the road.
I see. Yeah. A lot of great information. We're excited of all the great things that you're working on, you know, here locally and throughout our great state of Indiana, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Mr. Kevin Moore, President of Midwest Wind and Solar. And I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you, everybody.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio here on Wednesdays on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. And the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One, your search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking. McDonald's is typically known, of course, for things like McNuggets and Big Macs, but they'll also be known as some big projects that will mean some economic development in Northwest Indiana and around the state of Indiana, for that matter. We'll find out more about what expansion is in store for the more than 270 local restaurants of McDonald's in the next year or so. We have Rob Lancaster. He's Vice President for U.S. Restaurant Development with McDonald's, based out of Chicago. And Rob, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, great to be here.
Well, give us the good news here about changes that many people may very well see in their local McDonald's restaurant.
Yeah, we're really excited about the work that we're doing and will be doing between now and the end of 2019. As you mentioned, in Indiana, with 270 restaurants that we're focusing on bringing the experience of the future to, which includes you know, not only remodels but bringing a new enhanced service to our customers.
When you take a look at the typical McDonald's, we know we've seen the evolution of being the double arches in the old building that for the longest time was the typical McDonald's. Of course, was one of the historical McDonald's, and the big changes over time to just a very nice brickwork. What will some of these remodeling jobs basically show to the folks who come by for the sandwiches?
Yeah, it's really a new, fresh look, Chris. You know, we want to be contemporary, we want to be modern, but we also want to fit into your communities there in Indiana. So we're remodeling the exterior of the buildings. a new look to it. You know, still having the golden arches prominent within the architecture. New decor packages and new furniture on the inside to really enhance that sit-down experience. And then installation of digital kiosks, which is really the most visible point of change when you walk into the restaurant to know that there's something different. We're remodeling the front counters, opening up the front counters, and giving the crew an opportunity to have more interaction with the customer, which is really great in my mind. Adding digital menu boards both inside the restaurant and in the drive-thru. You know, the digital menu boards are contemporary, they're vibrant, they give us a great opportunity to communicate with the customer and then also them to use as a menu board. And then probably lastly, we're expanding and giving the McCafe area inside the restaurant a new look. So, you know, anything that's really customer-facing for the restaurant, we're touching and enhancing.
How long has it been for many of these restaurant locations since they had a major remodeling like this?
You know what? It really varies. Some of them it's been a long time. Some of them not so long. You know, the fact of the matter is we've always worked hard to evolve and keep up with the customer and do everything we can to meet the customer's demand. Some of them have been a little bit longer than others, but, you know, within the 18 months, we're going to touch the majority of our 14,000 restaurants across the country. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us.
Now, you mentioned about the fact that they were going to have more digital kiosks go up in the McDonald's restaurants. I know that there are some here in Northwest Indiana that are trying that out. In fact, I used one just the other day at the McDonald's here in Hobart, Maryville. They have that digital kiosk. It's very interesting. Once you work it, you know how to work it, it's very easy, and it's a much more convenient way to be able to put your order in and gets done that much faster so that all you have to do is go up to the counter and say, here it is, you know.
Yeah, you know, the great thing about the digital kiosk is it gives customers a different way to interact, and they've proven to be very popular. We have a guest experience leader that will be working the dining room that can help walk through anyone and, you know, show them how to use it, introduce them to the kiosk. But, you know, customers, you know, many customers want to do things and customize and do things the way they want it, and the kiosk just gives them a real easy way to do that. And they're a little bit of fun too. So they've been very popular, and we look forward to putting in more throughout Indiana.
Now, Rob, have many of the changes that folks will see in their local McDonald's restaurant, or all the McDonald's that are planning to be worked on here over the next couple years here in Indiana, are they basically changes that have been based on what the customer wants?
Yeah, you know what? That's a great point. You know, we've done a lot of listening. So let's just take table service for example. We tested table service in Florida and in California for about a year, and it was wildly popular, and it didn't take us long to realize that that's an enhancement that the customers really are looking forward to, and that's being introduced when we finish the remodel. So that's just an example, but, you know, it's all about listening to the customer and bringing them what they want.
Now, when you talk about modernizing the stores, will they basically kind of all look the same, or will they still have their unique individual look?
You know what? They'll have individual looks. They'll be uniquely McDonald's. You know, they're very branded. Where, you know, the exterior of a McDonald's, you know, we want you to know that it's a McDonald's. But we have various color palettes that the local franchisees can choose from to make it, you know, unique to their areas. The interiors also, we have an array of decor options for the local franchisee to take advantage of and, you know, put in the right interior decor that works for their customers. So uniquely McDonald's from a brand standpoint, but still tying into your local communities.
And I know that in addition to the digital kiosks that are going to be going up in the McDonald's restaurants, you also make it easier for folks either to pay, I guess, not only mobile phone, but also to take advantage of Uber. Tell us about this Uber Eats program that will probably be folded into that.
Yeah, you bet. You know, like I said earlier, really, really wanting to give the customers as many enhanced options from a choice standpoint on how they can use us. You know, we don't want to be in the business of telling our customers how they should use us. We want to listen how they want to. And a couple of things that were loud and clear to us were, you know, mobile order pay and delivery. So mobile order pay, it's a great app. You order your food. You can pick up inside, or we're also identifying a couple of parking spots in the parking lot that you can pick up from. You come inside, they know you're there, and they deliver your food either out to your car or if you come inside to pick it up. So that's working out really well, and has been very popular. Uber Eats, you know, continues to build and do well for us. The delivery platform, you know, being able to get our world famous fries right to your door isn't a bad thing. So, you know, both of those are enhancement that we've made this year and we'll continue to build on.
Now, I know that McDonald's Corporation is going to be doing some great things to make each individual restaurant look more modern in many cases. How close do you think that the stores might get to what the new flagship store in downtown Chicago looks like? Somebody's going to liken that more to an Apple store than to a fast food restaurant. Is the new flagship restaurant in downtown Chicago just as neat as an Apple store might be?
You know what? Selfishly, I like to think it's even better.
Well,
so, you know, we're really excited about that restaurant. You know, it has a lot of enhancements that you would expect a flagship restaurant to have. But it really showcases many of the things that we're bringing in to all of our local McDonald's around the country, and that we'll bring, you know, to those 350 restaurants in Indiana. Things like kiosks, things like the service platforms. Things like mobile order and pay. You know, they're really showing off at that downtown McDonald's location, but it's the same platform that we're going to bring to all of the restaurants across the country.
Now, since we know that this has kind of gotten kicked off with this modernization and expansion campaign in many cases, what kind of timetable, besides looking at the rest of this year into 2019, what kind of timetable are you aiming for?
Our goal is to be complete with the 270 restaurants in Indiana and the restaurants across the country by the end of 2019. You know, we'll have a couple that move into 20, but you know, we really want to move fast and evolve our restaurants at the speed of the customers. So we're picking up the pace. We've got quite a few under construction now, and that'll just build over the next 18 months.
Now, since we have all this construction work and remodeling work that's going to get underway, how much of this will make some difference in local economic development and particular for the local contractors?
Yeah, we're using a mix of local and then national vendors. The majority of the general contractors, subcontractors that we use are local, so a lot of great work out there for local general contractors and subcontractors within the communities across the country.
Well, that's good news to hear. Rob Lancaster, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Rob Lancaster is Vice President for U.S. Restaurant Development for McDonald's Corporation in Chicago. The Lake County Council yesterday heard a presentation about the feasibility of a new convention center based on the work that was done for the RDA by consultant CSL International. South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority President and CEO Spiros Batistatos was among those who made the presentation to the County Council, and much of what he told them yesterday was what he told us right here on Regionally Speaking on July 25th. Here's that conversation. Well, if you will, fill us in, you've had a chance to take a look at what the consultants from Texas have had to present to the RDA board. I know they were supposed to have voted on it, I think, today and receiving it from the consultants. Tell us what you know about the plan, how feasible a convention center in Lake County really could be.
Well, I mean, I think if any rational individual takes the time to do a couple of things. One, to take a look at the wealth of experience, professionalism, integrity, knowledge that is possessed by CSL, which is Convention and Sports Leisure out of both Texas and Minnesota. They've got a couple of different offices. Mm-hmm. These guys know their stuff, and they have helped and done this in hundreds of communities. It was interesting, I thought, yesterday when they made the point that they've said no before. That nobody benefits from, you know, coming in and going, I absolutely build it and they will come, and then the thing becomes an albatross or a failure. So they've said no quite a bit. They know their business, and they've provided the Lake County Council and the Lake County Commissioners through the RDA an exceptional study. Their metrics are on point, their analysis, the way it was done. Again, even if you want to be an ardent naysayer about the need for a convention center, if you look at the report, you read the report, and you have the ability to reason, I don't know anyone who could look at that and not say that we got our money's worth as far as real professionals telling us what our options are. Having said that, I'm personally, I'm thrilled. It came back better than I even expected. I mean, I've been advocating for this project, and our organization has said we need a municipally financed convention center, which we do not have in Lake County, and we need to be in control of our own destination. You mentioned at the opening of the show, Chris, that the Radisson Hotel is down, the theater's coming down, the Twin Towers. This is a private businessman who has single-handedly changed the landscape of the community and the drivers of tourism and hospitality. And that's his prerogative to do so. I've long maintained that a convention center would have complemented the Radisson project as it existed and will complement any future investment made anywhere in the county as we move ahead. So I was very pleased to see the report. I thought the numbers were even more optimistic than we were, and we've got 30-year knowledge of the market. So we're pleased, and I was very pleased with the reception we got by the elected officials yesterday. They were convinced, I believe, that this was a fair, unbiased, countywide study. And if you look at the top five sites, Maryville's represented, Hobart's represented, Gary and Hammond Highland. So I think that it's incumbent on everyone now to have intelligent, rational conversation about the need to generate $400 million over the next 20 years. Do we want to see an increase of $22, $25 million in local taxes? Do we want to see jobs created at that building and as well as others around it? Do we want to start reclaiming restaurants that might be vacant or building new ones or seeing new investment? That all you have to do is look at downtown Indianapolis and see what that building and the two arenas have done. So this is a long-term, game-changing economic opportunity to continue to build and diversify our economy. And that's what we're here to do. So sorry for the long-winded answer, but there it is.
Well, thank you for that. And we also mentioned, too, that, of course, the details of what we know right now about the plan is spelled out in both of the articles in the Times and in the Post-Tribune that they put out. They've gone through and broken it down based, I imagine, from the executive summary that the Convention Sports and Leisure International has put together. And I'm sure it was brought up at presentation before all of the officials yesterday to explain what, at least in basics, is the idea about the feasibility of a convention center in Lake County. Talks about things about, as you mentioned, the contribution of $400 million in economic activity over the next 20 years to Northwest Indiana, in particular to Lake County. We're talking about the idea of a 145,000 square foot complex. I've kind of called it, just the convention center and all of the other facilities, that will go with it. And I know that because we had the reliability of not only the convention facilities there at the Radisson, but the hotel itself and all of the other accompanying businesses in the area, they're recommending, of course, the same sort of setup, wherever it may be, too, I would imagine.
Well, a couple of things I'd like to clarify you on, because there are important distinctions in the business. The Radisson was never a convention center.
Right.
Whenever a hotelier builds some meeting space attached to their hotel, it's a conference space. That space was outgrown by the Indiana association market and in a number of other pieces of business really at around 2000, 2001. We haven't seen Indiana Association of Cities and Towns. We haven't seen Indiana Association of Realtors, Bankers, Law. I mean, all the Indiana Association business really stopped coming as then Indianapolis started growing, Fort Wayne was growing. We just got stagnant. So again, if we look back and look at what if we'd made this investment 20 years ago, and continued to have, we would have had more hotels, we would have had nicer hotels, we would have had more full-service hotels. Those are the things that follow. Secondly, in this convention center of 145,000 square foot for the convention center building alone, about 75,000 will be what we call front of house, 75,000 will be back of house. So whatever the final square footage you want to have to sell and hold events in, you need to mirror that with load-in bays, storage facilities, all those kinds of things. So there's a one-to-one ratio. So we're talking about building a 75,000 square foot usable hall, breakout rooms, ballroom, that kind of stuff. Then it needs 75,000 square foot backup house.
Yeah.
Sorry. And then the study is very accurate, and we don't need quite frankly, you don't need a study to look at and realize why you have to have a headquarters hotel. The Genesis Center was built in the mid-70s in downtown Gary with no adjacent really hotel property. And then shortly after that, the Sheraton closed. You can't sell these things if you don't have attached full-service hotels. So I don't think that should be a surprise to anyone who's ever been to any kind of a meeting. If you want to walk out of your hotel and walk to the convention center. And so the study points out the need to have other ancillary hotels around it, restaurants, attractions. So we've got a great example already here of a building that has no economic viability because it doesn't have any tourism infrastructure around it.
Yeah. Let's take a look at these four locations that the articles mention, the study mentions in much more detail, I'm sure, that seem to be at the top of the list. I'm sure there are probably several others that they have brought up in the report as well, too. They talk about four sites, I guess, in particular, and they mention, as we've mentioned, Merivale, Hobart. We also have Hammond Highland and Gary. We talk here about the possibility of a potential site there, the former Century Mall, which is located on US 30, not far from, along 30 and Broadway, I guess is the best way to describe it here in Merivale. Is that area, from what your opinion is?
I've long really championed the Century Mall site.
Mm-hmm.
I also really like, and I had a conversation with a councilman yesterday, this idea of this Hammond Highland Oxbow site, for a variety of reasons, I think offers us more of what the customer wants, being closer to Chicago. I think that the city of Hammond has some financing tools in its toolbox that no other city has. I think that when you look at the product and the opportunity to build that entertainment district that could be anchored to the north by Purdue Cal or Purdue Northwest and go all the way south to Highland downtown and that whole Kennedy Avenue spine for future development, there are a lot of choices here. And I think what I've talked to people about, Chris, is that these top five sites truly allow four municipalities to call in developers, investors, look at their TIF districts, look at what money they may have, and really step up and compete for this project. And that's what I'm hoping will come from this is that, I would love to see Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. and the town of Merivale competing and bringing assets and driving a better investment for this project. And that's what I think those five sites do. And I think that the Century Mall site, to go back to your question there, is the one that gets us out of the ground the quickest.
Mm-hmm.
Tearing down part of the Burlington Coat Factory building, building the building that is needed. You have outlots there. You have hotels around it. You have all the restaurants and retail in Merivale and Hobart. We could be hosting conventions in under 2 years at that site because all of the parking, the electric, everything's done.
Well, I was going to mention the parking. It's a huge parking lot to begin with because it was a mall.
Right. It's an adaptive reuse, and we're not cutting into green space or we're not trying to do a whole lot of other stuff. So every site in there, of course, the Radisson site has great attributes. The Majestic site uses the lake, which is one of the things I think that we have that no other community in the state, clearly south of us, has access to. So I think we have to have a meaningful, thoughtful conversation about, and when I say we, all of the policy people, all of the local electeds, the business community, I think we all have to get around the table and say which site offers us the way to tell our story, to build an economy, to put people back to work, to create investment for the next 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so each one of those sites has something that the other one doesn't. And I think that just shows, again, the kind of integrity and professionalism brought to us by CSL.
You mentioned about the fact that the local leaders had a chance to get a little preview of this at a workshop that was held Tuesday and had some members of the county council there as well as all three of the commissioners checking out what this presentation is all about and the feasibility plan. As you recall, did they have anything they may have said to remark to you perhaps or at the meeting about what they saw? It, It's a little early to tell whether they're going to support it or not, but they're the ones that are going to have to decide if there's going to be some way to finance it.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the questions was, and one of our, you know, a lot of time was spent with the group saying, look, let's focus on the economic justification of the project. Let's talk about what it means to the community as far as jobs and spending and all of the things that go with it. We've got plenty of time. And again, I go back, if those four municipalities are really competing for this, what we may need from the county might be a fraction of what they're thinking might be needed today. Mm-hmm. So if the county council thinks, oh my goodness, I've got to, you know, come up with $60 million today, well, that may not be the case. You know, one of these municipalities may cobble together, you know, 40 of it, and then we're having a much different conversation. So I think that the questions that were asked yesterday were thoughtful. A few of them were about the metrics and the kind of how the mechanics of the study worked. You know, I don't remember every question, but there was a lot of nodding of heads, a lot of understanding of the economic need. And I think 150 pages of any study, it takes some time for people to digest and be thoughtful, even on a 10-page executive summary. You don't just get it, read it, and all of a sudden you're completely knowledgeable about the topic.
And I understand, too, that as far as the entire presentation is concerned, the county council will all get together and get to hear it again sometime next month. At least that's the plan. So those who attended yesterday's session got a preview in a way, and then they'll get the full presentation all together and get to hear it then later.
I really think the RDA did a great job yesterday. The council and commissioner's appointment, Randy Palmateer, made sure that, you know, it got in front of them. It was released immediately to the public. It was done in a way so that nobody could say, oh, there's some back room. You know, here it is. About the time that those people were seeing it, it was live on a number of different outlets. It had been distributed. My board got it at almost simultaneously to them. So, you know, we want to take out any of these speculations. And, you know, this is a legitimate, important economic development project. You layer it along with the train. You look at what's going on the Marquette plan. You take a look at what this could mean. You take a look at the other headline today, $4 million for Lear Corporation. That's great headlines. So, you know, we understand the need for Hammond and all of our communities to have just as much at a traditional kind of manufacturing economy, as well as improving a service economy, as well as what's going on at Oxbow. All of these things help us grow a better community. We've never advocated, as the South Shore Convention Bureau, don't invest in anything but tourism. Well, of course not. We want U.S. Steel to be profitable. We want BP to refine a ton of oil. And we can all live together. And I think when you look at the headlines and see what's going on, it's a very, very good time to be in this community.
Well, we just have about a minute left or so now. And Sparrows, if you will, give us a clue, at least in your thoughts, as to what the next steps are going to be now.
Let me make this clear. We are not – the RDA is driving this. This is the RDA's project. They commissioned the study. They're on point here. We are, in essence, technical experts. You know, I think – what I think could be the next step is that we continue to brief the rest of the council and commissioners. I think that there's going to have to be a lot of communication with state officials, you know, in case there's something that's needed with an existing law that maybe needs to be amended or tweaked in order for the financing, you know, to happen as we start putting things together. So I think that the most important thing that could happen, Chris, is avoiding the rush to judgment. And the second most important thing that could happen is the avoidance of the very traditional zip code wars that go on in Lake County. If it's not in my city, we're not going to do it. No, you know what? Let's not play that game. Let's realize that our economy doesn't see city borders. Our economy, we may have people that live in one municipality, work in another. And I don't know the time we have left, but I always joke and say my eye doctor's in Whiting. My gym is in Schererville. I live in St. John. My butcher, you know, is in Dyer. You know, whatever it is, we don't do all of our business in one city, and we shouldn't think that way anymore. And I think that's going to be important for people to remember.
Spiros Bostatos is the present CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. He was one of those present for the workshop, and the people from CSL came in to explain the feasibility plan, at least the executive summary, and the 140-some page full study is now in the hands of people that are going to have it, or they will be getting it pretty soon and have a chance to mull it over and work on it to be sure. Thank you for stopping by and giving us your thoughts on this and what you've seen and heard from the presentation the other day. That's the Spiros Bostatos conversation with us on July 25th. The Lake County Council got their presentation on the feasibility of a new convention center on Tuesday. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions voiced by man-human Tom Maloney, and the Ollie's responses are from his woman-human, Victoria Voller. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I'm horrified at what I witnessed yesterday while driving near a railroad in Gary. It was three children who appeared to be about 13 years old chasing a tiny dog. The game was clear. Chase it, catch it, then throw it up against the train car. I immediately stopped the car and captured the dog. Their statement to me as I slammed the car door shut was, "We'll just find another dog to terrorize." I wasn't sure what should happen next. The little Chihuahua mix's jaw was hanging to the side. I took the dog to our local vet and he waved his fee to fix the jaw. I left the vet physically shaken by the experience, but confident that this dog would receive the best care possible. Signed, Anonymous, from Gary. Well, Victoria, I can only assume that Ollie is going to have a pretty thorough response to this letter, but just really heartbreaking. You hear stories of animal abuse and animal neglect, and so often it's done by grown-ups or adults who you think obviously should know better, but to hear about kids also doing it to animals, and you have to wonder, where did they learn that from? And that's a tough one to read.
It's a tough one. I mean, if you're going to get your kicks by hurting people or animals, that's a whole different issue. Dear Anonymous, thank you for your efforts on behalf of all pets everywhere. However, though this animal is safe, there is a greater worry. Since the 1970s, research has consistently reported childhood cruelty to animals as one of the first warning signs of later types of delinquency, violence, and criminal behavior. Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, found guilty of killing 13 women, shot arrows through dogs and cats he trapped as a child. Columbine shooters Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold boasted about mutilating animals just for fun. Other serial killers who abused animals are the Son of Sam, who shot his neighbor's dog, Brenda Spencer, who lit the tails of cats and dogs on fire, Jeffrey Dahmer impaled a dog's head on a stick. Theodore Bundy, he learned this from his father, how to torture small animals, and he went on to murder 40 women that they know of. Edmund Kemper killed cats and went on to kill 8 women, including his own mother. Andrew Coonigan, who murdered Gianni Versace and Chicago Marilyn Miglin's husband, used to torture sea crabs. According to some psychologists, there are three types of animal abusers. A preschool child who has not developed the cognitive maturity to understand that animals have feelings and they are not toys. Secondly, a child who intellectually understands that it's not okay to hurt animals, but they abuse animals as a response to witnessing violence or abuse in their own home, or teens who abuse animals while engaging in other antisocial behaviors. Sometimes the animal abuse is in conjunction with a deviant peer group, while other times it may be used as a way to alleviate boredom or achieve a sense of control or just getting a high by watching another living creature suffer. If anybody in the audience knows of any child who exhibits this behavior towards animals, it is this abuse that points to a lack of empathy and propensity towards violence. And many psychologists believe that this is a serious warning sign of horrific behavior to come. I conclude this letter by saying, I'm very worried about the future of these three boys, but I'm more worried about the animals and people whose paths they certainly will cross while growing up. Ollie, your friend in fur, love is a four-legged word.
If you have a question for your friend and for Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Back with you tomorrow.